You're listening to the Belfer Center's Office Hours. This episode...
Having just the smart leader is not sufficient. You really have to change the decision environment in a structural way.
Harvard Kennedy School professor and social psychologist Jennifer Lerner, special advisor to the U.S. Chief of Naval Operations and the Navy's first chief decision scientist, talks about decision science, leadership, and the sunk cost bias. For more insightful conversations with experts from the Belfer Center and beyond, subscribe to Office Hours on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform. Here's host, Arup Mukherjee.
Let's start off with the biggest question. What is decision science, and what are some key ideas in the field?
Sure. Decision science is an interdisciplinary field that sits primarily at the intersection of psychology and economics. So, economics has historically been the dominant field when it comes to decision theory. It's the field that has given us the rational actor model and told us how human beings should make judgments and decisions. So, for example, if you're trying to decide what to choose, you consider a number of options and you might calculate which option gives you the highest expected value and then select that option. Economics is what we call a normative or prescriptive approach to the study of decision making. And by that, I mean that it tells us a prescription, what you should do. Here is how you should make a rational choice. Psychology is newer to the study of judgment and decision making. And what we get from psychology, rather than a prescription, is actually a description. It tells us this is how human beings actually do make judgments or decisions. So decision science is the intersection of the prescriptive approach, this is what you should do, with the descriptive approach, this is what people actually do. And then add to that mix, sometimes you also would say it sits at the intersection of not only psychology and economics, but also neuroscience. And where neuroscience comes in is that it helps us identify some of the brain mechanisms involved in these judgment and decision processes.
How different are those two worlds? What is the discrepancy between the prescription and the description? Is it often that they align, or is the world that psychologists describe vastly different from the world that economists prescribe?
The reason that it's actually such an exciting field to work in is that the two perspectives often are in tension with each other. And the everyday version that you might hear in casual conversation is humans aren't rational actors. We're so stupid. You know, everybody thinks Homer Simpson like approaches to decision making. And that is certainly a mischaracterization of the tension between the two fields. Human beings are, of course, exquisitely smart, and we've evolved as a species to do things that no other species on the planet can do. So it's not a matter of intelligence. It's really a matter of understanding what the boundary conditions are on the human brain. And that's what makes this exciting, is that when everyday human judgment and decision-making departs from the normative or prescriptive model, it's not because we're dumb. It's not because of random error. It's because of lawful relationships that govern how the human mind works, relationships and laws of human nature that through science we're beginning to understand. The departures from rationality are actually very systematic and predictable.
And so things like, you know, never go to a grocery store when you're hungry, or the tendency of people to double down when they're losing, or eat a snack when they know they're not going to feel good afterward. Are those the sorts of things where what you're saying is they're actual, not only are those predictable, but there are good reasons for those things that save us in other situations? Is that the idea?
Well, so those are all interesting examples we could talk about. What I have in mind, though, is that there are couple of key principles that help explain in a very broad sense why it is that humans depart from rationality. And one of those is that we have what the late Nobel laureate Herb Simon called boundary conditions on our thinking ability. And one of those key bounds in the famous term bounded rationality is that our human brains are best at thinking carefully when we can think in sequential fashion. So when we have to think in parallel, many things at once, we don't do as well. We have a finite capacity for attention. And so that that boundary condition is one of the things that leads us to make mistakes. The most classic example that everyone's familiar with is we can't text and drive at the same time without being at risk of accidents because we just don't have that kind of infinite capacity for attention. One of the main reasons that artificial intelligence is useful to us is because of the fact that our brains are really best at serial information processing. That's S-E-R-I-A-L, as opposed to breakfast cereal, as opposed to parallel processing. So that's the first major boundary condition. The second that allows us to predict where mistakes are going to be made is that a lot of the thinking that we do occurs non-consciously, and it's not accessible to our own introspection. So we engage in what's called implicit associations, where we are unaware of the fact that many of the things we're doing for reasons we don't fully understand. John F. Kennedy actually had a famous quote about this. Even though he worked long before the days of neuroscience and didn't have access to all of the latest scientific results on implicit cognition, he said that decisions are often opaque to the decision maker himself. And so even someone as introspective as he was makes decisions without realizing all of the factors that brought about that decision.
How many decisions are humans making every day? Thousands?
There's a huge debate about what constitutes a decision. And so what we're learning from the literature is that we are making non-conscious choices all the time. And factors in our environment are leading us towards those decisions. And then the question is, do you call that a decision? Or do you have to actually be conscious of the decision?
Like walking, for instance.
You mean like, should I walk this way
or
that way?
I guess there are many things that sort of feel, could fall into that category of, it is kind of a decision, but it's not really because it's just, I'm just doing it.
Yeah. So even if you're in the supermarket, marketing firms have figured out that you need to have a cereal at a certain height. In order to, and they can quantify the increased likelihood of you buying it based on its height on the shelf. And so you may think you bought that because you really wanted that, but really you bought that because it caught your eye, because it was in the prime position for you to see it.
Do you have any favorite findings in the field of this decision science that are either counterintuitive or something that just is... was surprising to you?
So I think every researcher has to have at least their own findings be some of those quote favorite findings. And so within my own research, I have a couple of favorite findings. One of them is I need to first tell you there's a very well-known finding in the field of decision science. It's called the endowment effect. And the endowment effect is an economic anomaly that you're likely familiar with, where if I were to give you something, like a mug in the classic demonstration, and then ask you, how much would you require me to pay you in order to sell it back to me? You would give me a price. And in an alternative condition, I might just hold up the mug and say, how much is this mug worth? How much would you be willing to pay to buy? It's always the case that once we own something, even if we've owned it only for a minute or two, we value it more. And so sellers require a higher price for something than buyers are willing to pay. And that's known as the endowment effect. Once you've been endowed with it, you assign a higher price to it. So that's a robust finding in the field. And when early on in the field, the field was very much dominated by a cognitive perspective, so emphasizing how cognitive factors affected judgment and decision making. And my colleagues and I were trying to show that emotion has been neglected and that emotion isn't just an epiphenomenal set of feelings that you have on the side, but emotion is actually can be causal and highly impactful. So we showed that you could reverse the endowment effect when you just induce people to feel temporarily sad. And so if you put people in a sad state by just reminding them of things that they've lost or relationships that they've lost, or you show them a short, sad film clip, people then pay more to buy something and are willing to sell whatever they own for less. And so it completely reverses the endowment effect. And that effect received a lot of attention because it was one of the first times anyone was able to show that emotion can actually reverse what we believe is a common human tendency that is robust and reliable across situations. And it does so even when real money is at stake. And it helped a number of people to say, we really need to pay attention to emotion.
I took a class with Richard Zeckhauser called Analytic Frameworks for Policy. And it was an introduction to some of these concepts. And Professor Zeckhauser said, you know, after you're in this class, you will look at the world differently. And everything that you see, you will start to see in the framework of things like the endowment effect, let's say, or status quo bias, or a lot of these other things that are now very mainstream ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Do you apply some of those findings? Are you, as a scholar, as an expert on this field, do you find yourself self-analyzing all the time? Do you find yourself applying these things to your friends' decisions? Do you see it everywhere?
Absolutely. So it is a lens through looking at life. And we joke about sunk cost bias all the time. And I also use it all the time. I use it in my work with the Navy. We're doing a lot of research on sunk cost bias. One of the things we've discovered when we've tried to teach people about sunk cost bias in executive education is that they don't believe it is a bias. They think that there are social costs for acting rationally and writing off prior investments when they start to look bad. So we're actually doing a set of experiments on what the nature of those costs are and how do you create the conditions that will enable leaders to actually write off some costs without being punished for it. So it's fair to say we're fairly obsessed with these effects, not just that we think about them a lot. And my whole family knows these. I've taught them all of the major phenomena. So they use it against me, for example.
Go on.
So I remember once we bought tickets to the symphony, and my husband doesn't actually like the symphony, but I love the symphony. And so I had expended social capital to convince him to go to the symphony. Then by the time the symphony came around, I was sick with a cold. And I didn't want to go in terms of how I felt, but I wanted to go because we had spent so much money on these tickets. So, of course, sunk cost bias is saying we should go because we spent so much money. So my husband, who is not in this field, cleverly used the field against me by saying, well, I don't think we should go, honey, because that would be sunk cost bias.
How did you respond?
Oh, I was annoyed. And it made me want to dig in and go to the symphony all the more. So,
the irony.
Yeah, the irony. And that's the thing about these biases is that the knowledge doesn't mean you don't still want to do all these things you shouldn't do.
Yeah,
it just means you do them. you either painfully stop yourself from doing them or painfully do them.
What's the capacity for self-correction? Because I do want to get to foreign policy and leadership and decision-making.
Sure.
How do you self-correct?
Yeah. So, you know, the symphony thing is truly just a joke. But there is, I think, enormous capacity for self-correction. I do it in the context of experiments, for example. We've had hypotheses that we loved, lines of experimentation that we loved, but when the data didn't come out the way we wanted, there comes a point where you have to write off everything you invested in a particular line of work and say, we shouldn't continue. And anyone saying, but we've come this far, or that we've put so much in, or anything like that, that you would typically hear in the narrative of escalating commitment to failing courses of action, no one in my lab would ever say that because they've self-corrected. And they know that what you put in the past is irrelevant to a decision on future investment. So that kind of self-correction happens every day. At the much broader level, at the political level and Defense Department expenses and multi-year programs of investment, that sort of thing, there, it's much harder to self-correct. And we think what really needs to happen is two things. One, you can educate leaders so that they're aware of what sunk cost bias is and they're aware how to calculate future expected value, and which has no role for prior investment. So yes, educate them on that, but that's not sufficient. It's only necessary. In order to fully solve the problem, you have to create a culture that is an evidence-based decision-making culture where people are actually rewarded not so much on does the idea you had 12 months ago turn out to be right, but instead rewarded on the process you use to analyze what's right and what's not right. And that, a number of biotech firms and leading Silicon Valley firms have started to adopt. They even have parties where they celebrate failures. But that is not yet happening in our Department of Defense.
And if there's one thing you could teach a policymaker about judgment and decision science, what would it be?
It's really hard for me to boil it down to one thing, but I would say that decades of research proves to us that having just the smart leader is not sufficient. You really have to change the decision environment in a structural way and apply what Thaler and Sunstein call choice architecture. So to make an environment, a decision environment that helps everyone make smarter decisions. And by that, I don't necessarily mean you have to nudge people. I mean, you need to apply behavioral science to create a smart decision-making environment.
And so that means that leaders are no better at decision-making than regular people, or at least that's what I'm gleaning from what you're saying, that they too require self-correcting mechanisms and processes that help incentivize them away from some of these decision-making mistakes.
I'm definitely not saying that leaders are no better. I think that people who get to the position of admiral, for example, only do so by being extremely smart and skilled. However, even the smartest among us needs to be aware of these tendencies and to have the right kind of decision environment in order to reinforce smart decision making, because every single one of us is wired up, for example, to choose the risky option if you frame a choice between a gamble and a sure thing in terms of losses, and then switch and choose a sure thing over a risky option if you just frame the exact same choice in terms of gains. That's just a fundamental human tendency that prospect theory has taught us.
Do you see among these leaders, do you see any common traits among them about maybe how they process stress or how emotional they are or what they are good at avoiding?
I would say there's great heterogeneity. just like there's great heterogeneity in the academic population. And at least at the Admiral class, they all have in common that they are very smart. And I think that a lot of the stereotypes about senior military leaders are not true. So I haven't found a closed-mindedness, for example. I haven't found a lack of curiosity. And what I have found is that this is an audience that is highly attuned to small margins for error, and they are extremely eager to benefit from the field of decision science. When most of the people who are in top leadership positions were in school, decision science wasn't a well-known field. It's a much newer field. My colleague Baruch Fischoff and I, back when I was on the faculty at Carnegie Mellon, founded what I believe is the first undergraduate major in decision science in the country. And that's back in the department that the late Nobel laureate Herb Simon founded, which is called the Department of Social and Decision Science. And we did that in, approximately 2000. Around the year 2000. So this is a new field. And a lot of the innovations are happening every day. And so the senior leadership is really working to learn it, to master it, to put it to use.
How did you get interested in this in the first place? Are you a decisive purpose person?
I'm an insatiably curious person, is what I am. I'm a person who loves to think. And I could spend all day thinking about decisions. The reason I choose to study decisions, let me back up and say, the reason I have a PhD in psychology is because I am fascinated by human behavior. And it's endlessly interesting to me. And then the reason I chose decision making as the particular aspect to focus on is that I think decision making is where the workings of the human brain meet the world. That's kind of the moment where the brain translates into action. And so I think that's a fascinating moment. And it also seemed to me at the time that I came into the field that I might be able to make a contribution because I happen to have a lot of training in emotion, the science of emotion, and it seemed like the field was really overlooking that. So the two kind of came together.
And in the field of emotion, what is the role of emotion in decision making? And what does being angry or sad or fearful, what does it do to how we make decisions?
There's a lot of different ways to answer that question. So historically, psychology saw no role for emotion in judgment and decision making. And in fact, the whole early part of the 20th century was dominated by what's called behaviorism, which is quite different from like behavioral economics. B.F. Skinner, who was here on the faculty at Harvard, was one of the founders of behaviorism. And one of his famous quotes is, emotion is the fictional cause to which we attribute behavior. So in other words, if you think emotion matters, you're completely wrong. And don't deceive yourself. So that was the whole first half of the 20th century, no role for emotion. Then, and for that matter, no role for cognition, was just stimulus response. Second half of the 20th century, psychologists thought, oh, wait a minute here. Turns out it's stimulus thinking response, and that launched the cognitive science revolution. So it wasn't until actually the turn of the century, really around the late 1990s, when people started to say, wait a minute, once again, emotion does matter. And what we now know is that emotion actually travels faster in the brain than does cognition. And so if you're walking through the woods, for example, and something suddenly makes a sound, the your sensory thalamus will register that in your brain and send a signal to the amygdala, to subcortical structures, that will send another signal to your motor responses, and you will jump back before you've had time to think about it. And so at the same time, the sensory thalamus will send a signal that goes through your cortex and then over to motor neurons. And in other words, at the same time that a direct path happens straight through emotion, another path happens through cognition, but it's slower. So long story short, emotion is primary in many respects, and in that it happens first. And so for people to say, I'm not emotional or don't be emotional, is in some sense not really possible. Emotion is there. We're learning much more, to get to the latter part of your question, about what emotions do. Old school of thought was negative emotions lead to a pessimistic outlook, positive emotions lead to an optimistic outlook. That's really a gross overgeneralization. A lot of our work has shown that you need to unpack specific emotions. And so we've shown, for example, that fear and anger have opposite effects on the perception of risk. Fear leads you to perceive more risk. Anger leads you to perceive less risk. And in fact, when people are angry, they are more risk-taking than if they were in a neutral state.
They're optimistic.
State. Yes, they're more optimistic. Wow. And they take more risks, and they don't realize that they're doing that.
I wanted to ask you one last very quick question about where you see the cutting edge of decision science right now, and if it is still emotion, if we're still kind of figuring it all out, if it is AI, or what are the things that are yet left to explore?
In this young field, there are many frontiers. Emotion is most definitely one of them. All the big questions about emotion remain to be answered. We don't know, for example, what the half-life of emotion is. And so we see lots of effects where emotion carries over and colors subsequent judgments and decisions, even when people don't want it to carry over. We don't know how long that duration is. There are many different questions there. So I would say that is certainly one frontier. Another frontier is looking at social contextual effects on decision-making, norms, and how social norms operate and can, even without people realizing it, affect judgment and decision-making. In the context of national security and innovation more generally, one of the biggest frontier questions in decision science is trying to figure out what will ultimately be always a human advantage, comparative advantage, versus what will be a machine comparative advantage. It's not the case that machines are going to turn out to be better than the human brain on all dimensions. It's going to turn out that humans will be better at some things, machines will be better at other things, and we have to be smart about having outstanding analytic frameworks for detecting where the comparative advantage is on each specific process.
Professor Lerner, thank you so much again for joining. We loved having you here.
Thank you.
Office Hours was produced by the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government.